on. Good morning and welcome to Jonesy, the show that brings you conversations with some of the most interesting people in the world of books, podcasts, radio, theater, music, and humor, guaranteed to entertain and enlighten. I'm the host of Jonesy, Ken Jones, no relation, by the way. On today's episode, we welcome Patricia Horvath, author of the new story collection, But Now Am Found, from Black Lawrence Press. Patricia is the author of the memoir, All the Difference, and her stories and essays have appeared in Shenandoah, Confrontation, New Ohio Review, and the Massachusetts Review, among others. She's the recipient of New York Foundation for the Arts Fellowships in both fiction and literary nonfiction, the Goldenberg Fiction Prize at Bellevue Literary Review, and the Frank O'Connor Fiction Award. She teaches at Framingham State University. Author Heather Harpham says of But Now Am Found, in spare, precisely detailed prose, Patricia Horvath delivers a moving collection of stories that roam the low tides of life, the chemo ward, the stepchild's realization that she's unwanted baggage, the loss of a beloved parent, with a keen eye for small tendernesses that, if they don't redeem, truly soften life's blows. Please join us for our conversation with Patricia Horvath, which is already in progress. Patty, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me on the show.
Well, the new book, But Now I'm Found, is a collection of very moving stories with a thread of grief and loss running through them. You dedicate the book to your late husband, Jeff, and started writing, Patty, when Jeff was being treated for cancer.
He was being treated. Some of the stories, the stories are divided roughly evenly between stories that have to do with my childhood and stories that have to do with my adulthood as the spouse of somebody who'd been diagnosed with terminal cancer. And those stories, the adult stories, came later. I was working on those during his treatment. The earlier stories from my childhood and a couple of the adult stories I wrote earlier than that.
You wrote a memoir before this, All the Difference, and I know some of the stories comes out of those same experiences that you experienced as a kid. Now, your dad died around the same time as Jeff, so that was early in the pandemic, or early 2020.
He died about 10 months after Jeff did.
Oh, 10 months, but still, I can only imagine what a blow it was. You lost two of the people closest to you in the world during a terrible time, very trying and uncertain time, the pandemic. You must have been overwhelmed by your own sense of grief and loss.
It was hard. I'm working on a book now that's about being at once a caretaker for a spouse who's terminally ill, a cancer patient, because I had my own cancer diagnosis during this time, and COVID. So it was like a tsunami. And because of COVID, the hospice workers would only talk to us on Zoom. And so it was just me and my husband and this box of drugs that hospice sent us and figuring out how to navigate all of that. And, you know, I'm not a nurse, I'm a writer, I'm an English major. And it was a very difficult time in a sense. There was nothing but time. And so there was time for me to begin to process this and think about it and even begin to write some of the pieces because the whole world had shut down. So there was nothing for me to do, which in a sense was a blessing. I could be there with my husband at the end of his life and care for him and think about what was going on and begin to process it. But it was also, you know, COVID, it was so isolating. And then to be isolated with somebody who's terminally ill was not the easiest time of my life.
Even for those of us not going through that extreme grief that you were, it still seemed like the world could end in any minute.
Well, at every minute, all the time.
Yeah.
I mean, I live in New York, the sirens would go by. We had the refrigerator trucks. It was ending for everyone all the time.
Now, about those essays that you wrote, the project you're working on now, there's a few that have already been published about your own feelings, like you said, as a caretaker when Jeff was going through the treatments. And there's titles like Envy and Gluttony, Diligence and Patience, with the idea of structuring them around, obviously, the seven deadly sins and then the seven cardinal virtues. Diligence and Patience are two of those. Why that structure for the series?
When Jeff was going through treatment early on, all I was really able to do when I would accompany him to the hospital was take notes. I couldn't really process what was happening. I should say I tell my students, I write out of what I term vexation and inquiry, meaning something's bothering me. and I have to try to figure it out. And so that's what's undergirding these essays. And at the time, I was reading Mary Jo Bang's translation of the Inferno. And I thought, you know, this is really interesting. And this could be a way to get some distance from the very raw emotional experience of being in the chemo suite or undergoing treatment myself. So it was a way to get some critical distance from the experience. And then as I began to write, everything sort of fell into place. It was easy to find things to say about envy or gluttony.
Now, that theme of grief and loss runs through many of the stories in the new book, not just for loved ones like Jeff who died, but for broken families and marriages, lost friends, lost dreams.
Lost illusions.
Lost illusions, yes, especially childhood illusions. What was it like dealing with your own grief through fiction and the characters you created for the book, rather than, say, through creative nonfiction like the essays you were working on and still are working on?
That's a good question. With fiction, I think the part of the reason why I started writing these as fiction, you know, when I first started tackling this project, it wasn't nonfiction, it was fiction. So get some distance from it, because I was still inside of it. And I think I want, you know, write about somebody else's experience, write about another woman in the chemo suite who's not you, write about a woman who's lost her child, but it's not you, and it's not you, because these things, like I said, it happens to everyone all the time. You're on one side of the river, some invisible river, and then suddenly somebody says a sentence, this is terminal, or, you know, we found your son, and you're on the other side of the river. And I think writing it as fiction let me get a little distance from that place.
So kind of a way to work with your feelings, but in a, maybe from a distance, a kind of that third person versus the first person.
It's interesting, because I think a lot of the adult stories are third person and the childhood stories are mostly first person.
Yes, I noticed that.
But I didn't notice that until I had the whole collection together.
Yeah, one question that came up, but I wasn't going to ask, but now that you mention it, what does the third person give you? What does the first person give you? How do you decide?
Well, the third person gives you some distance. And I was writing about some things that were very vexed emotionally. And so I think that writing about, again, someone else's experience, or writing from a perspective that is not the perspective of somebody who is undergoing the trauma, but a distant, a third person limited voice, allowed me to have some distance from the experience. And then first person, I was really, some of those childhood stories I was just having fun with, because the voices in those stories are kind of magical and wacky. And, you know, there's a girl who, there's a lot of magic in them. There's a girl who wants to communicate with spirits via Ouija board, or
yes,
trying to turn herself into a witch. And those were just fun to write from the first person.
Oh, that was Griswold.
Griswold. In Griswold, she's trying to, she hates her stepfather, so she's trying to turn herself into a witch.
Now, there are 17 stories in all in the collection, and I promise not to go through all of them, but thought we'd talk about a few. Now, the very first, Wakey Nights, really sets the tone. It's about a mother awaking in the very early morning hours doing a crossword puzzle while waiting for her 16-year-old daughter to return home. It's kind of like what you just said about being on one side of the river, something happens, and all of a sudden you're on the other side. I guess the analogy I was thinking of reading it, it was like she was standing on a railroad track late at night, just waiting for the train to hit. Why'd you start with that story? A very powerful and brief story.
Well, that story and the stories, the collection's final story, which is Sunrise, I see them as bracketing the collection, because they are both about that moment, that last moment before the awful clarity hits. So the woman's daughter in Waking Nights hasn't come home, and she suspects that something's very wrong, and she's doing the crossword puzzle to ward off. There's a lot of rituals in the story. I'm really interested in the way we use rituals to ward off fear or grief. So there's a lot of people doing things that are repetitive, and she's doing the crossword puzzle to keep her feelings at bay. And then instead of, well, I don't want to spoil the story, but her daughter doesn't come home. Some guys in trench coats show up. And then in the final story, it's the woman has not yet, she only has a glimmer. She has an intuition. She wakes up with an uneasy feeling, and the phone is about to ring, but it hasn't rung yet. And we know what happens to her son in the story. She doesn't. But I am interested in that. You know, there's that moment where the sun is still shining and the birds are still chirping and everything is fine. And then there's that moment of awful clarity and nothing is, again, ever the same. And I'm interested in that idea. And so those two stories I wanted to have be the bookends for the collection.
And the characters in both stories, I think, have some idea what's coming. Yeah. The dread is evident and they just want to stop time, stop the world at that moment.
I think we want to do. We want to stop time.
So the inevitable doesn't happen.
Yeah. This, to me, was a really resonant idea, trying to stop time, trying to keep, trying to stay in that moment before the clarity arrives. Because you, once that happens, you can't change it.
Now, the collection's title story, But Now I'm Found, has its roots in your own experience. And by the way, this won the Bellevue Literary Review's Goldenberg Prize in Fiction. It's about a high school girl who wears a back brace and compensates for her disability by being a very good and accomplished student. Mm-hmm. She has a boyfriend who's not quite as diligent in school. He's a bit of a slacker, but he treats her well. It starts off, quoting from the story, the brace encased her chin to hip, hard plastic and metal. She wore it for her spine, that snaky column, a second body to reshape the damaged one. Winter, the metal at her neck was cold, filmy with fingerprints. Summer, it was too hot for him to touch. Now, you had scoliosis as a child, which you talk about in your memoir, and underwent similar treatment at about the same age as the main character, 15 years old?
I did. I wrote a memoir. My first book was a memoir entitled All the Difference, that came out with Etruscan Press a few years ago. And that was, I became interested in the way that disability is depicted in literature and how often it's conflated with moral failing. Also, I was interested in the relationship between disability and self-identity and what happens to your sense of self when a physical disability ceases to be visible, your sense of self and how others treat you. So the memoir was about that. And I did wear that brace. And so I'm not the girl in the story. The girl in the story goes through a religious conversion. But I'll tell you a funny story, which is that when it won the Bellevue Literary Award, the Goldenberg Award, the editor called me up and said, oh, you know, I really love this story. And part of why I love it is because I'm from a religious background like that, too. And I'm not. We were like Catholics who went to the hippie church and sang the Bob Dylan song, the guys home from Vietnam, and it was nothing like that. I just based that on my imagination and a trip I'd taken, driven through an abandoned Bible camp in northern Maine once on my way somewhere else. So I was really gratified that my imagination was apparently good enough to make this woman who was from an evangelical background believe that I was too. That part of the story is a fabrication. The brace part, I was drawing on my own experiences.
And when you teach the class, I think you've mentioned maybe two better known examples of physical disability ceasing to be visible or healing and what happens, the Ugly Duckling fairy mm-hmm. tale, and then of course, Beauty and the Beast. How did that experience of getting the back brace off, of somewhat straightening the spine, dealing with the scoliosis, how did that change you and how people perceived you?
That's a really good question. I mean, people who ignored me previously started talking to me. Boys started talking to me, and I'm 17 maybe at that time, just turned 17, but I had no knowledge of how to talk to boys or flirt. So this was all very new to me. I was not adept at it, and it was a lot to navigate. And I also suddenly started having rules applied to me at home, like curfews that I never, when I wore a brace, nobody paid that much attention. And suddenly you become aware of all the ways in which young women are sexualized that I was spared from, in some sense, by wearing this brace for so many years. And then it happened very quickly, and it was a lot to try to navigate.
Did you change in terms of your outlook? Going back to the Ugly Duckling, the Ugly Duckling is very depressed. Nobody wants to be with the Ugly Duckling. Mm-hmm. He goes off on his own, kind of a self-imposed exile. And then all of a sudden, the other ducks start welcoming him. And he looks in his reflection in the water and sees that he's beautiful again. was there some kind of transformation for you like that in terms of self-identity?
Well, it's such a good question. I don't know that I ever had an aha mirror where, a moment where I looked in a mirror and said, oh boy, looky, looky. You know, I think that I retained a healthy sense of skepticism based on having grown up with a disability and seeing the way that I was treated. And so I don't know that I really kind of trusted some of the reactions that I was getting that were favorable now. At the same time, I was so damn relieved to have this brace off. I mean, it was like a torture. I don't know if you've ever seen one. They're metal and they're plaster and they're heavy. And then I was in a body cast and that was plaster from my chin to my knee. And, you know, I was just so giddy. I'm sure that I came across as a happier, more optimistic person just to get all these weights off my back and be able to lie in the sun or go to the beach. To me, these were remarkable experiences that other people had taken for granted. And I'm sure made me feel happy. It's just so long ago, I don't remember having any kind of epiphany of, well, this is better.
And you kind of knew who you were, and that didn't change. It was just the way others perceived you, and that made you a little happier, it seems.
I think so. I mean, there's certainly a sense of skepticism when you're told, for instance, you do these exercises and then you won't have to wear a brace. And then you do the exercises and they say, well, that didn't work. You wear a brace for a few years and then you won't have to have surgery. And that doesn't work. And then you have to have surgery. There's a little bit of a sense of there's a shoe up in the sky. When's it going? And I don't know that that's ever left me. But I don't know that it's a bad thing either. I don't think it's necessarily a bad thing to be.
Not at all. It seems that you're kind of looking at reality more rather than perception.
It can help with critical thinking, skepticism, right?
Right. To a point. Now, one recurring situation in several of the stories involves children, usually girls, growing up with divorced parents. Either the mother has a boyfriend, usually not a good guy, you know, somebody strict, intolerant, irresponsible, or the father has, you know, a younger girlfriend leaving the mom for, you know, a sexier woman. And the children have to not navigate these difficult circumstances over which they have little control. That has some of its roots in your own family growing up, Patty. I think you said your mom was divorced twice. Your dad was living separately in New York, in Manhattan.
My dad was an early adapter of the deadbeat dad phenomenon. So he left us essentially when I was about 9 or 10. And we didn't see him for quite a while. And then eventually we started visiting him in New York. He got an apartment in Manhattan. My brother and I would visit him. And that was like Oz to me. I loved it. I just thought, oh my God, this is where I want to live. But he was very erratic. And, you know, you never really knew when you would see him. And he would forget things of special occasions, not be there. So I learned early on. And I also knew that my mother had been in foster homes as a child. She and her younger sister in the 1940s, after my grandfather came back from World War II, they split up, my mother's parents, and my mother and my aunt were sent to live with strangers for years, for like 3 years. And I knew it was a very difficult experience for them. And so I was very aware that adults could just leave. They could just, if they didn't like it, they could leave, which was my experience. It wasn't the experience that I saw on television. It wasn't the experience that I saw in my friends' lives, but it was my experience. And I also, you know, being a reader, knew what happened to orphans in Charles Dickens. So this idea of the broken, so-called broken home was something that resonated with me and that I wanted to explore in my work. What happens to these kids when the adults just decide to throw their hands up in the air? Mom did not do that. I want to be clear. My mom did not do that, but I was also aware that she was really the only competent adult in our life, and that anything happened to her, we'd be in big trouble.
Yeah, and some of the kids in the stories are self-aware too. I think one kid says, you know what happens with stepchildren.
They go in the basement.
Yeah.
Nobody loves them. Yeah.
Right.
That was me. That was me really thinking of the way I did as a kid.
Now, it's funny you mentioned about Manhattan seeming like Oz to you as a kid. I told you before we started recording that I grew up in Queens in Flushing. And even though technically it's part of New York City, it really isn't. We always considered going into Manhattan, the city, where we live was not the city. And you use a few of those memories, I think, of visiting your dad in that high rise on the East River. There's a story, Never Let Go, where the main character is a 13-year-old girl, and she's treated to a night on the town, treated in quotes, by her mom's boyfriend, Roy, not the most responsible of guys. And they visit Radio City Music Hall because she's always dreamed of seeing the Rockettes. I just knew going into the city, I remember going to Radio City Music Hall and seeing a movie there and the Rockettes. And, well, you really capture that excitement. Being that it's Oz, you must have felt the same way I did, or maybe a lot of other kids did.
Oh, it was marvelous. On the one hand, I was a little scared because, you know, that story adheres pretty closely to the factual. On the one hand, I didn't really know this person, and it's an adult, and I'm a 13-year-old, and should we be even be going out together? And I wasn't told where I was going, just get on the train, and suddenly we're in New York. On the other hand, it's a Radio City Music Hall, and it's gorgeous, and it's, you know, those giant red lights, and the Rockettes, and the carpeting with the guitars on it, and the chandeliers, and then he took me to the Rainbow Room. It was like one of the best dates I ever went on, except that I was 13, and kind of nervous about, you know, whether I should even be on a date to begin with.
But certainly you hit the heights of Manhattan that night, though.
Oh, yeah, the Rainbow Room.
Now, my favorite story in the collection, certainly the one that hit me the hardest, is called To the Stranger Who Brings Flowers. And again, I think it's based on what you were going through at the time. It's about a woman named Olive. And she makes regular visits to a chemo ward for her own cancer treatments. She recently lost her husband in his 60s. They had been married a long time. And this one nurse giving the IVs who acts pretty stern and cold towards the patients, Olive included. The point of view alternates between third person close from Olive's perspective and the nurse Mara. And we get to know them intimately through these sections in a way they don't know each other. They're basically strangers, and they judge each other based on these brief encounters, and the reader knows more. They could look more into the what's happening inside these two characters. It reminded me of the Raymond Carver story, A Small Good Thing, in that respect, if you know that.
I was thinking of that story when I wrote it.
But the question I have is that story actually has a resolution and a reconciliation at the end. Yours doesn't have that. There's really no catharsis, I think, for the reader, though it had me in tears reading it. But why did you make that decision? Carver went
I guess you could say it's more like, you know how Carver wrote The Bath before he wrote A Small Good Thing? And The Small Good Thing was The Bath rewritten.
Oh, no, I didn't know that. I don't know that.
The earlier version of the story called The Bath. And it just ends with the baker calling the home and saying, yes, it's about Scotty. It's about Scotty. And you don't really know what's going to happen next. And I only like the way that it ended on a note of tension. So there is these two women are connected through grief. They find this out about each other. They don't talk to each other about it. And part of that is, you know, they're respecting each other's grief. And the nurse doesn't want people to know that she's grieving, and she can hide it because she's not ill. But there's a small act when she makes tea at the end of the story. That is what I was thinking of, that moment where the baker opens up the bread and says, you know, eat this. It's a small good thing, that beautiful, that's like opening up the communion wafer.
Yeah, she leaves a tea and a cookie for Olive.
Yeah, she leaves tea and a cookie, and, you know, maybe they'll talk. Probably they won't. She understands that Olive's a person who's been leaving flowers on her son's grave. And Olive doesn't know that she knows that, but Olive does know this thing about her, and they are connected in their grief. And they're each struggling because Olive's lost her husband. Mara's lost her son. And I was writing that in the chemo suite. I snuck myself and my husband into that story very stealthily. He is the guy with the hoodie with the skull on it, playing cards with a dog.
Oh, make a cameo appearance.
Yeah, he always wore this hoodie from the Delacour Theater where they have Shakespeare in the Park in the summer, and it was from Hamlet, and there's a big skull on the hoodie, and we would play cards, and sometimes the service dog would get in Jeff's lap and sleep, so I snuck him in there.
I figured there must be a connection, because in the essay you wrote, Envy, I think that came out in 2014, it describes Jeff visiting a chemo ward to treat his cancer, And I'm quoting from the essay, Jeff is shown to a recliner, his IV set up. He's been assigned to Gina, my favorite nurse. I like her because she's funny and wisecracking, unlike Mara in the story. Like the female sidekicks in the old movies, Jeff's taken to watching Eve Arden and Mildred Pierce, Thelma Ritter in Rear Window. Also, unlike the other nurses, she lets me buy her coffee, which makes me feel useful. And when I read that, I just thought maybe that was the roots of this story that I like so much.
Maybe. I really think that, you know, I was drawing Mara in opposition to Gina. Gina was an actual person, was Jeff's actual nurse. And we were always glad when she was the one assigned to him because she was so upbeat and so friendly. And I just thought, well, what if I created a nurse that was the opposite of that? So I had that in mind as somebody to, you know, let Mara as a kind of a Gina antagonist. Because really, you want these nurses, oh my God, they work so hard. And you see some of the stuff that some of the things, the patients have nowhere to put their anger. And the doctors aren't available, and the doctors are godlike. And so some of the patients would vent at the nurses, and you'd understand why, because what happened to them is unfathomable. It's unfair. They're sick. They're in pain. It doesn't make sense. And the nurses are the ones who are there. But if you have a nurse like Gina in that situation, you are very, very lucky. And so Mara's kind of the anti-Gina.
The anti-Gina, but I think one of the reasons the craft that you show there, the skill, and why the story works so well is Olive is seeing Mara as the anti-Gina. Mm-hmm. But the reader knows, yeah, there's a reason there.
He doesn't know at first, but eventually the reader understands why Mara might be the way that she is. And eventually Olive comes to understand that. We understand it first. We understand it before Olive does.
When we were emailing, Patty, you mentioned an interview I did with Kai Emmons last December. And Kai, at that time, used a text-to-speech device with great difficulty. She was down to typing with one finger on one hand. She had ALS, a kind that had taken her voice first and then her body was just breaking down. And sadly, it was the last I got to talk with her before she took her own life through Death with Dignity. You told me that Jeff chose the same path. That must have been extremely difficult for you. Well, certainly for him too, to make that decision.
He didn't choose to take his own life, but he did choose to stop palliative treatment.
Ah.
A little different. The palliative treatment was really no longer working. And they told us at Sloan via Zoom, because again, this was in July of 2020. So they told us via Zoom, really, there's nothing left for us to do, at which point he went into home hospice. So it was a little different. He just let it happen naturally, I guess is the word. His body just, after about 6 weeks, he was at home, and I was able to keep him at home, which is what we both wanted. So there is that. But yeah, it wasn't assisted suicide.
Yeah, in Oregon, there's a program where you have to, I think, at least get two doctors to prescribe the medication, the fatal medication, and that's what Kai did.
That's such a powerful thing.
Yeah, it's taking agency over your own life.
Yeah, and people should have that agency. We don't have that option in New York. That was nothing that we could do if he had even wanted to. It wasn't something that we can do in New York.
Yeah, and you told me when you mentioned about Kai and that last interview and her struggles with health and mortality, that her belief that connection with loved ones is all that really matters is something that came out, I think, of your own struggles and maybe informs your own writing.
Yes, I mean, what else do we have? And when I was at the lowest point of my life, when Jeff was, you know, at the end of his life, even though it was COVID, people showed up. People showed up for me. I remember telling my best friend who lives in Connecticut, I'm afraid. What are you afraid of? I said, I'm afraid of being here alone when he dies. And she said, I promise I won't let that happen to you. And she showed up. She's a remarkable person. She showed up with a bag of collard greens, a caulk gun, and made me a bunch of collard greens and caulked my bathtub. She knew that my bathtub needed caulking. So she just drove up from Hartford, had the caulk gun, had the collard greens, and she would cook for me. And I would try to get Jeff to eat, and I would look after him. And I had someone looking after me. And then my mother, who was already in her 80s at the time, showed up. And another neighbor brought food to me. And, you know, these are the things. This is like leaving the tea and the cookie. What else are we here for?
Yeah, it almost seems like a lot of people need to be almost at their lowest, though, to come to that realization. Before that, it's ambition, money, power. But that doesn't get you anywhere past a certain point.
And moral certitude is something I've become very interested in, that some of the stories are about. And that doesn't get you anywhere either. The girl who wears the brace, you know, she has a religious conversion. And that story has a companion piece, Hold On Fast, where the young man has a religious conversion.
He says he's born again, and he burns all his Black Sabbath records and starts listening to Barry Manilow.
Starts listening to Barry Manilow. I don't understand the connection between bad music and evangelism, but I've seen it in action. And I'm fascinated and frightened by this moral certitude that I think that we see more and more of every day. And I don't understand it. And that, again, when I don't understand something is when I try to write about it. Just yesterday, I was reading the paper, and the governor of, I think, Wyoming just signed a bill outlawing abortion drugs, which are legal. The FDA approved them. And he said, "I did this without bias and guided by prayer." And I thought, well, there's an oxymoron.
Oh, right, a contradictory statement.
And these are the times we live in.
In fact, now there's an actual federal judge in Texas who's looking at banning, not just in Texas, looking at banning a particular abortion drug in the entire country. I don't understand that kind of power or that kind of, what you said, that moral certitude.
I don't understand that kind of power or moral certitude either. That's why I write about it, trying to understand it. It seems toxic to me.
But of course, a lot of religion is based on that, unfortunately.
But it's also the opposite of what we're talking about, which is the caring that, you know, people evince for each other, whether or not it is under the auspices of a church or a religious institution or just people loving each other and caring for each other, which is a very powerful thing and can happen certainly outside of any kind of organization.
Yeah, I didn't mean to say all religion. It's a dark side of religion, where you start feeling you're right, everybody else is wrong, and they should do what you do. Where Christianity, I think, is basically based on love and compassion for others. A lot of religions are, but not a lot of people who follow those religions practice that.
Well, I told you what my experience of Christianity was. We sang Bob Dylan songs and tried to end the Vietnam War. I mean, that was a peace and love. So.
And I know there were priests at the time who also were trying to end the Vietnam War.
Well, the Berrigans were among them, sure.
Now, I think another, not to dwell on Kai so much, but she was so impressive to me, her writing and Kai as a person. Another theme you actually have in common, Patty, I think, with her writing is that of women, both young and old, disappearing, of not being seen. She had a story collection all about that called Vanishing. And I definitely see that recurring in your work, whether the disappearance is due to disability, age, class. In your memoir, All the Difference, you mentioned that, quote, you wrote a story in which a woman, a poet, is shrinking so rapidly that she has to carry a milk crate to stand on. When she disappears entirely, no one notices. And in the new collection, you have a story with the title Value Added, A More Fabulous You, where the lead character thinks she's shrinking. It's kind of like both you and Kai are shining a light on those characters who seem to be discounted and ignored, shunted aside, and may have little power. Maybe their only power is their own resilience, their own ability to keep going in the face of all this.
That's actually the oldest story in the collection. And I wrote it when I first moved to New York. That was the turn of the millennium. I lived in Harlem, and Harlem in 2000 was very different than it is now and very different than Manhattan below 96th Street. And I would go below 96th Street to teach. I was teaching at Pratt at the time. And some of the things that you would see and some of the things that you would be exposed to on the subway, like ads for Dr. Zizmore and ads for breast augmentation and ads saying this is how you should look, or reading about this new restaurant that had opened where they put gold flecks on the food. Or actually reading, and this isn't a story, but it is actually something I came across, a couple who had plastic surgery and liked it so much they decided to have plastic surgery for their children as well, so they'd all look more alike. I thought this, we're at the end of the world here. And I became really interested in shrinking, because that's when I was diagnosed with osteoporosis, shrinking as a metaphor for the creative person in this crazy consumerist vortex that was Manhattan at the turn of the millennium. So it is about class. It's about the, you know, the people who are the underclass, or this person who is the narrator is an adjunct, so she's being exploited financially and is broke. And it's about the way we don't see those people.
And she's at a party at her brother's house where her sister-in-law and her sister-in-law's friends are very wealthy and fairly obnoxious about it.
Fairly obnoxious. And then she gets to be obnoxious too.
Now, Patty, you teach classes at Framingham State University, and there's separate classes on writing memoir, writing fiction, writing creative nonfiction. Mm-hmm. What do you tell your students about using these different forms, and maybe which ones are best for the stories they want to tell?
Well, as for what's best for the stories they want to tell, I think that's something they have to figure out. I wouldn't tell them that. I mean, if we're in a class that is on writing fiction, we're going to write fiction. If we're in life writing, we're going to write memoir. If we're in a class where we do both, that class is an introductory level class. And so I want them to get experience doing one of each. By the time they're in a seminar with me, the ones who decide to stick with creative writing and take the capstone seminar, I just tell them, you have to decide what story it is you want to tell and how you want to tell it. And I can't tell you that. And so it's really for them to figure out. And I don't say that it has to be one thing or another, because you don't know. And you don't know until you're actually doing it and realizing, you know, when I wrote But Now I'm Found, I tried to write it from the girl's perspective initially. It didn't work. But you don't know until you start doing that. And that's okay. The mistakes, like we were talking about before the interview, mistakes are things you can internalize, incorporate, learn from.
I read that your first book, All the Difference, which is a memoir, started out as a short story.
Yes.
It wasn't working, and that's why you turned it into a memoir instead eventually?
Well, I workshopped it. I have this fabulous group of women. I met them in grad school, and we called ourselves the Fiction Chicks, and we met every Thursday night for dinner and to workshop our own work outside of workshop, where we could really give each other some very serious attention. And I workshopped a story, and it was the girl in the brace and was in the story. And they just said, well, they started talking to me about what's the genesis of this. So I told them about my experiences with bracing and scoliosis and spinal fusion and having to relearn how to walk. And I'd known them at this point maybe 3 years, 4 years, and they said, oh, we never knew that about you. And I realized, no, because I don't talk about this, because I wanted to just close the door on it. And that's when they said, well, this is what you've got to write about. You know better than this if it's bothering you this much. And you know you can't just close the door on your life. That door doesn't stay shut. And I knew they were right, but I was resistant. I just thought, oh man, really, a whole book about this? Ay, ay, ay. And then I started to write, and I would show it to people, and they'd ask questions, and there would be more, and there'd be more, and there'd be more. Now I don't show my work so much, but that was my first book, and it was very helpful to get their feedback.
Going back to something you said earlier, Patty, then when you wrote it as a short story, it allowed you to get some distance from your own experience, but mm-hmm. then you had to immerse yourself in it more, certainly mm-hmm. confront it more, writing it as a memoir.
Yes. And my friends were saying, this is the story we want to read. This is the story we want to hear, but we didn't know this about you. And, you know, the fact that you don't want to write it, that's the story. The fact that you don't want to write the story is the story.
The vexation.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. That's conflict. You know, internalized conflict, and stories arise out of conflict. No conflict, no story. No change, no story. You know, a man goes to the store, buys a loaf of bread, comes home and eats a sandwich. That's not a story.
No, not one that I'd want to read, but Now, do you ever look back on the stories in the collection and remember how you felt when you were writing? Because you're going through this extreme grief, this sense of loss, the sense of dread, the world ending. I just wanted to stop. I was on one side of the river, and now I'm on the side of the river I'd rather not be on. Maybe like some of your own characters facing their grief in the book and just wanting the world to stop, as in the last story in the collection. Hopefully some of that very raw, painful grief has softened with time.
It changes. It changes. In the immediate aftermath of grief, I can only speak for myself, but in the immediate aftermath of my own grief, it was difficult just getting through the day. And I have a very good friend who helped me a lot and who knows something about grief. And he said to me, this year, all you need to do is eat, sleep, hydrate, and breathe. And I would say that to myself like a mantra. And really, that was about all I could manage. And then it took a little while. After about 6 months, I started being able to sleep in my own bed again. And after another 6 months, I was able to start, you know, exercising and going for walks and doing yoga again. So, you know, on a functional level, it's much better. But I think when you lose somebody you love dearly, that loss stays with you.
The writing must have helped. I mean, Jeff is gone, but he kind of lives on as an influence.
He designed the cover of the book, which makes me really, I find that very gratifying. I was going through a whole bunch of his images. He was a photographer and a graphic designer, and I was going through a lot of his photos. And we used to go into Central Park, and he would take photos of the flowers and make them abstract. And I found that image and I thought, this is it. This is the image for my book. And I sent it to my publisher and she said, oh, it's beautiful. I love it. Let's use it.
Yes, it's beautiful and perfect. It's flowers and kind of taken out of focus. And there's shades of white, pink, and rose red in there.
The flowers in poinsettia, which are a metaphor for blood cells. In that sense, yes, he does live on. And I, of course, dedicated the book to him. And I know that he'd be very happy about this. He was very happy when my first book came out, and he designed the cover for that one as well.
Patty, thanks so much for talking with us, being so direct. I know other people go through it, and the beautiful stories that you wrote, I think, help us as readers feel less alone.
I hope so. Thank you so much. I really enjoyed our conversation.
Well, that's all for this episode of Jonesy here on KBOO Community Radio. If you missed any part of the show, or would like to hear the longer, unexpurgated version, the director's cut, you might call it if we had one, you can listen anytime on demand at kboo.fm/program/Jonesy, J-O-N-E-S-Y, or just search for it on the KBOO website. Before we head out the door, a big thank you to our guest today, Patricia Horvath, author of the new story collection, But Now I Am Found, from Black Lawrence Press. If you happen to be in Cambridge, Massachusetts, she'll be reading and signing books at Porter Square Books this evening at 7. You can learn more about Patricia, her work, and all her upcoming events online at patricialhorvath.com. Just a reminder that KBOO is in the final days of our winter membership drive. We call the drive All Thrills, No Frills, a tribute to the special programming you've come to expect from the station. Programming like our annual Bluegrass Marathon, for example, coming up this Saturday. And we're asking for your help. KBOO is true listener-sponsored community radio. We get 80% of our funding from our members, listeners like you. We wouldn't be on the air without you, and that's been the case since the station started broadcasting back in 1968. You can support programs like this and independent media by becoming a member today or renewing your membership. Just go online to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. All of us here at the station, even Jonesy himself, thank you for that. Jonesy, by the way, comes to you every other week on the second and fourth Thursdays of the month from 11 to 11:30 a.m. Tune in for our next show on Thursday, April 13th at 11 a.m. I'm your host, Ken Jones, no relation, saying,